From WIPR, I'm Sheila Kast. We're On the Record. We explore an unorthodox approach to preventing violence in the community. We'll talk to Maryland shock trauma surgeon Dr. Carnell Cooper, who for two decades has been intervening in the emergency room as victims of violence recover to help them change the patterns that led to that violence.
So we have an opportunity to save their lives. In fact, we have maybe even a little bit of an obligation to try to do something beyond just patching them up.
And Baltimore City Health Commissioner Dr. Lena Wen fills us in on plans to expand the city's Safe Streets Outreach Program into numerous city hospitals, beginning with Johns Hopkins Hospital. It's On the Record after the news.
You're listening to On the Record, the podcast, a service of your public radio, 88.1 WYPR. Find more podcasts online at wypr.org. And tell us what you think. Send an email to ontherecord@wypr.org.
Good morning, I'm Sheila Kast. We're On the Record. We're talking today about an unorthodox approach to stemming violence, an approach that begins in the emergency room. In 1998, after seeing the same victims of violent injury show up again and again at the University of Maryland Medical Center's shock trauma unit, Dr. Carnell Cooper started an effort to break that cycle. Nearly two decades later, he still heads the Violence Intervention Project at the University of Maryland Medical Center's R. Adams Cowley Shock Trauma Center. And he's here with me in the studio to tell us about it. Dr. Carnell Cooper, welcome to On the Record.
Thank you for having me.
Later in the show, we'll hear from Baltimore City Health Commissioner Dr. Lena Wen about a grant the city has just received to start a violence intervention program in other city hospitals. But first, Carnell Cooper, tell us what inspired you to start the program at the University of Maryland Medical Center all those years ago.
Well, what inspired me to start the program was that I saw these young men repeatedly coming back to the shock trauma center with violent injuries. You know, the Shock Trauma Center is a world-renowned trauma center, and its record of saving lives is not comparable to any place else in the country. It does a great job. But when it came to violent injuries, that was the one place in which we saw repeat victims back. We almost never saw repeat victims from car crashes or falls or any of the other blunt, nonviolent injuries. But we kept seeing these young men of violent injuries come back again. So the question was, what could we do different? What was different about the circumstances around their injury versus others? And we knew what we thought was the answer. But being an academic center, we asked an academic question. And we said, what were the things that put them at risk of being a violent injury? We did a study, and it showed, not surprisingly, there were things like being poor, being in a violent neighborhood, having victims of violence, other members of the family, substance abuse, not having a job, low incomes, all those things that we all knew were there, but then we had data to support that. So that's what got us on the road to say, okay, we have a problem. We know what the problem is. Let's figure out a solution.
But you're a medical doctor. So when you're talking about poverty,
yes,
why did you think that you could
change
those?
You are so correct. And you point directly to the problem why it wasn't done before. And the reason was because we're a trauma center. Where are the tools for us to address the issues that I just outlined that are the problem? Well, having grown up in the same kinds of neighborhoods that were producing these violent injuries in Baltimore, I knew that these individuals were not patients who were your Jeffrey Dahmers or John Wayne Gacy's, people who had sociopathic issues that couldn't be addressed. I knew that these were individuals in tough situations who made mistakes, who were down in a position and did not know how to get themselves out of that position. But I knew that if we addressed the issues at the right time, while they were in the hospital with their injuries were fresh with them, their families at the bedside, that I thought that they would respond, because I knew it wasn't because they didn't want help. It's because it wasn't there, and we didn't have the pathway or the tools to get there.
Okay, so walk me through a case. Somebody,
sure,
a patient comes in,
mm-hmm,
gunshot wound.
Mm-hmm.
You work on that with your medical tools.
Correct.
Then what?
And as soon as that patient is at a point when they are stable and we think that we can begin to talk to them about the issues that put them in the hospital, we will. We meet them at the bedside and we ask the things that the medical team don't ask. The medical team asks me, is your wound healing okay? Or can you eat, et cetera, et cetera. We ask questions like, well, what happened out there you think that caused this event? And where do you live? What's your neighborhood like? Do you have your GED? Do you have a job? Do you have any skills that can help you get a job? Do you have a substance abuse problem that we can help with? We ask those sort of social issues that we know from our study puts him at risk for being a victim of violence. Him or her, I should say, as well. And whenever you leave our hospital, what are you going to do? Are you thinking about retribution for what happened to you? Do you have a safe place to go after you leave here? What are your plans? So these are not the questions that patients get asked when they normally leave the hospital, but we know those are the questions that we should be asked if we're going to keep them coming back and being a victim of violence. The data tells us that they will come back. Data at our nation's trauma centers say that 30 to 60% of all our victims of violence will come back again. When they come back for a second or third time, their chances of dying are higher. In some studies, as high as 10 times higher than the patient who comes in who was a victim of violence for the first time. So we have an opportunity when they come that first time to save their lives, because of what could happen subsequently. In fact, we have maybe even a little bit of an obligation to try to do something beyond just patching them up.
This is On the Record on WIPR. I'm Sheila Cass speaking with Dr. Carnell Cooper, who nearly two decades ago started one of the first hospital-based violence intervention programs in the country. Speaking of data, you were interviewed by the New York Times 5 years ago, and it cited statistical results of VIP. 83% decrease in repeat hospitalizations for violent injury, 75% reduction in criminal activity, 82% increase in employment. Are you still getting results like that?
Absolutely. We are still getting those kinds of results. In the study, we had narrowed down the kind of patient that we saw. There was a little bit more of a hammer behind what we did. But still, even for the folks who engage in the program still significantly, we still get great results. We still, most importantly, save lives.
When you think back over the years, what have you learned about curbing violence? What is the distilled wisdom that you can share with other programs?
You show you care. When we arrive at their bedside, we are there because we don't want them to come back there. We're there because we care about you as a human being. How can we help you get a job? How can we help you get involved in some skill training? We are there because we care about you as a human being. We are not judging you or asking you, were you a perpetrator in the event that put you in the hospital? We are there to say that we don't want you to become another victim of violence.
When you described a few minutes ago these questions being asked, someone who's just been pulled back from serious injury, or someone who still is recuperating, is that doctors asking these questions? Who's actually displaying that concern that you just described?
So we have our caseworkers, and our caseworkers are individuals who often are from similar circumstances. They are from similar neighborhoods, from West Baltimore and East Baltimore. They know some of the individuals who come in the hospital or may have gone to the same high school. So they are aware of the kinds of circumstances that that patient came from and therefore can relate. They can speak at a level that makes an immediate bond, that breaks down the barriers that our patients often have when they find themselves in our hospital. patients in our hospital sometimes angry. They're upset. They feel that the folks who are taking care of them are looking at them as being criminals, etc. So we walk in, and all of a sudden, there's someone who is from the same neighborhood that they grew up in, who speaks the same language, who's showing empathy, who's not judging them. And all of a sudden, those barriers, after a few visits, they melt away. And it may not happen on the first visit. It may take two or three visits. But the message is still the same. We're not judging you.
Are there patients who just say, I don't want to deal with you?
Absolutely.
I got issues in the neighborhood. I'm going to deal with them. It's not your problem.
Absolutely. And, you know, at some point, we may say, okay, we've tried. And after two or three visits, we say, okay, here's our card. If you change your mind, call us. And some do. You know, for the young 16, 15, 18-year-old, there is still that feeling of immortality. In fact, sometimes there's that feeling, well, I survived this. That gives me stripes in the neighborhood, and that really does support my immortality, how tough I am. Because I survived this. They shot me two or three times, and look what I was able to do. But we don't buy into that. We still see them, and we still ask those questions, and we address those that kind of immortality. We tell them that folks do die. We have straight conversations about those kinds of thoughts, and we involve their families, because sometimes if the mom or dad's at the bedside crying, and we are there to help, and that patient is not interested, having them at the bedside, don't leave. Let me talk to him first. You step outside for a moment while I have a conversation with him. So we use everything in our arsenal to try to break down the obvious barriers that our patients may have.
How is your program funded?
For a number of years, it's funded by grants, and it's still funded by grants. We do get some significant support from a university. They have, over the years, realized the importance of the program, and they, like any other institution, want us to make sure that we had data that said we did what we did. So we were funded initially by grants, but over time, university has been very supportive and has, in terms of personnel support. Still are primarily supported by grants from various entities around the state and around the country. But as I said, we get significant support from university.
So can you offer this intervention to every victim of violence who shows up at Shock Trauma?
At our hospital, our goal at Shock Trauma Center is to see every victim of violence who shows up to the trauma center. It is all about what can we do to save the lives of these young men. We're about saving lives of our young people, because every time I see a young man come in and dies of a violent injury, it really bothers me, because I see my neighbors that I grew up with, I see my friends I grew up with, I see my family, and I see the circumstances that put them at risk that they had nothing to do with.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Dr. Carnell Cooper, head of the Violence Intervention Project at the University of Maryland Medical Center, R. Adams Cowley Shock Trauma Center. Quick break now. When we come back, we'll hear from Baltimore City Health Commissioner Dr. Lena Wen about a plan to expand the city's Safe Streets program into emergency rooms. Stay with us.
This is the On the Record podcast, a service of Your Public Radio, member-supported 88.1 WYPR. You can support this podcast and everything you hear from WYPR. Become a member. Come to WYPR.org and click the donate link.
Welcome back to On the Record. I'm Sheila Cast. We're talking today about stemming community violence by reaching out to victims of that violence in the emergency room. The Department of Justice recently awarded a $500,000 grant to the Baltimore City Health Department to support a comprehensive hospital-based community violence intervention program. The initiative aims to expand the city's Safe Streets program into local hospitals, beginning with Johns Hopkins Hospital. Baltimore City Health Commissioner Dr. Lena Wen is with me in the studio. Lena Wen, welcome to On the Record.
Nice to speak with you, Sheila.
How did this initiative come about?
When I was practicing in the emergency department, working in the ER, I saw so many patients who had previously come in with a violent injury, and now we're back again. I'll never forget this one patient that I saw who was 17 years old and had been shot 5 times, 3 times in the chest and 2 times in the abdomen. Mm. While we were working to resuscitate him, I recognized him, because I had just treated him a few weeks before when he had a gunshot wound to his arm. And then we looked at his medical records and saw that he also had been treated in the ER 5, 6, 7 times before that for other injuries related to violence. He punched someone and had a broken hand. He was assaulted in his head. I mean, this individual had literally been in our system so many times. We had so many opportunities to intervene, and we didn't. And now he was lying on our table and he died that day. And I think about him and I think about how every interaction we have to take is the opportunity to intervene. And so we want to expand our very successful Safe Streets program. We hire individuals who are the most credible, trusted messengers to walk the streets of the city and interrupt violence. These are also individuals who have had great success with intervening at the time that someone is the victim of violence to stop that cycle of violence and trauma.
But Safe Streets, as I understand it, it's people who have formerly been in the game, who have been on the other side of the law for the most part, who have the credibility to talk to somebody who is walking that path now and say, don't do it. Very different to go into an emergency room.
I would argue that it is very similar. There is the understanding of violence, that it is a public health issue, because violence is something that spreads from person to person. It is contagious, just like a disease. It is something that can be prevented. It's something that can be treated. And that is what our Safe Streets employees do every day. Last year, they mediated over 700 conflicts, and the majority of those conflicts were deemed to be very likely or likely to result in gun violence. So they're saving lives every day, preventing further violence, further gunshot wounds, further trauma from occurring. That's the same thing that we're asking for individuals to do who are doing violence interruption in the hospital setting. And what we have found in the case of our Safe Streets work is that the reason why conflicts are occurring sometimes could be fairly minor, or what we would see as being fairly minor. Sometimes they are about $20. Sometimes they are about major life issues like finding housing, finding employment. That's something that our Safe Streets employees are skilled in doing and in interrupting violence and stopping conflict through intervening in these other social factors that are leading to hardships in people's lives. And that's what they will be doing through our hospital interrupters program as well, so that there is a direct connection for the individual once they leave the hospital. You know, it's a humbling realization for me as an ER doctor to realize that, you know, I may treat this person very well in the hospital. We all know great medicine. We can do fantastic trauma resuscitation care. But then that person goes home, and that person goes to the same environment that potentially led them there in the first place.
We just spoke with Dr. Carnell Cooper of the University of Maryland Medical Center about the violence intervention program that he started in 1998. How will the one that you're launching differ from that?
I am a big fan of the work that Dr. Cooper has done. This is something that I have seen work in practice, as well as I've seen the fantastic data behind the work that Dr. Cooper does and why it's so effective. And so the model that we have for hospital violence interrupters through the Department of Justice grant is inspired by Dr. Cooper's work. We coordinate very closely with him, with shock trauma, and we are hoping that this will be the beginning of a citywide approach.
So the same violence interrupters who already work at five different places in Baltimore City will now work at the Johns Hopkins Emergency Room?
It will be an expansion of our existing Safe Streets work, but with the additional capacity that they'll also be working in the ER setting so that we're stopping violence at that point.
This is On the Record on WIPR. I'm Sheila Cast speaking with Baltimore City Health Commissioner Dr. Lena Wen about a grant the city just received to launch a hospital-based violence intervention program in emergency rooms, beginning with Johns Hopkins Hospital. Why start with Johns Hopkins?
Johns Hopkins was a willing and very capable partner, so we're working with them for the purposes of this Department of Justice grant. We're also working with Sinai Hospital and LifeBridge, and there is also interest by several of our other hospitals for us to pilot this in their EDs as well. Our goal is to work to expand this. One of our biggest challenges in dealing with violence in our city is that people see the outputs at the end of it, and the end of it is terrible. It's when somebody is dying or has died. And it's also extremely expensive, not to mention the ethical component. The cost of gunshot wounds in our city that's just recently been estimated is $80 million over 5 years, just in the city, just for medical costs alone. One individual who was shot who has a spinal injury will cost society over $500,000 just for medical costs, not to mention all the spending we have in incarceration, all the lost economic costs of productivity of an individual whose life was taken away from them when they're young. When we think about that cost, that's what we're currently investing in, as opposed to programs like Safe Streets, programs like Hospital Violence Interrupters. It's such a small amount, but ultimately it is about preventing terrible things from happening and really saving lives.
Over the summer, state funding for Safe Streets was nearly cut from the budget. Governor Hogan ended up providing enough funding to keep Safe Streets operating through this coming January. How will you keep Safe Streets afloat come January?
Well, let me add to this and say that we have found a way for Safe Streets to be sustained throughout this entire fiscal year. So we are okay until July of next year, which is fantastic. We were able to get $500,000 from the governor's office. We were also able to work with our federal government. We got a grant from the Centers for Disease Control Prevention. We've been working with the Department of Justice. We also had support from local funders here in the city who have allowed us to keep this important life-saving program of Safe Streets afloat. We were really in desperate straits. We were looking at potentially the closure of our five Safe Street sites by now. We were in a situation where within a month, we would have had dozens of our employees who are doing such amazing work be out of work, and potentially to see crime and homicide spike in these areas that have been dependent on Safe Streets.
But so, that's exactly why I'm wondering, is this the right time to be expanding when ongoing funding for Safe Streets seems so shaky?
But Sheila, I would say that that is the case for all of our programs in public health, not just in Baltimore City, but for all my counterparts across the country. The funding for public health is always this close from getting cut. This is the problem that we have for every one of our programs across the board. The problem with public health is that, as the saying goes, public health saved your life today. You just don't know it. It's very difficult to put the face of public health. There is the face of someone who was shot, and that person can talk about how the trauma care that they received was excellent, and that's why they're alive today. What about the face of someone who was not shot but could have gotten shot had it not been for the intervention of Safe Streets employees? This is the argument that we have to make for every single one of our programs. That does not stop us from expanding our work because, number one, we know it's evidence-based. Number two, we know it's life-saving. And number three, it frankly would be unethical for us to withhold a life-saving treatment from a patient in front of us. So why would we withhold something that is life-saving that is a value added to our communities here in Baltimore City?
And you've gotten some good news about funding.
We did. We received two large grants in the last month or so. One is for building community resilience around trauma in West Baltimore. The other one is for trauma care and mental health services in our schools. In total, they are over $7 million over the course of several years. Most of that funding is going to be going directly to our communities. They'll also be going to our schools to expand mental health care. Part of what we're doing in our schools, for example, is to ensure that everyone who comes into contact with our students, whether it's a teacher or principal or social worker or a police officer, receives training in how to understand and recognize the impact of trauma. We don't want to look at individuals as the perpetrator of violence. You can't do that without also recognizing how every person is also the victim of deep trauma. It's understanding, addressing, and being honest with ourselves about the roots of what is causing our violence. This did not occur overnight. We've had decades of disinvestment and disparities and poverty and discrimination. And we have to be honest about what those issues are and how even if somebody didn't suffer from physical trauma, there's deep emotional trauma that comes from not knowing whether you'll have a roof over your head or whether you'll have dinner that night or growing up in a family with domestic violence and alcohol and drugs. And all of these things are what we hope to address in this grant because ultimately it's also stopping that cycle of violence and trauma.
I really want to keep in touch with you about those grants as they proceed. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Baltimore City Health Commissioner Dr. Lena Wen. The Health Department recently received a $500,000 grant from the Department of Justice's Office of Juvenile Justice and Delinquency Prevention to launch a violence intervention program based in hospital emergency departments. This is On the Record, WIPR. I'm Sheila Cass. Glad you've been with us. Come back tomorrow.